Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's June 3rd, 2018, and welcome to episode 173 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and alternate universes. I'm your host with the most, Earl Evans. I'm out here in Portland, Oregon, way over on the left coast of those United States. And I'm going to be herding the cats today for the Retro Computing Roundtable event. And we're going to start with the DJ of eBay. The guy from the state with a lot of letters, that is Massachusetts, Paul Hagstrom. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing just great. Happy to be herded.
Excellent. Both herd and herded.
Yep. I would have had one more eBay auction today, except it's kind of dangerous to look for eBay auctions for this podcast. I wound up buying like half the things I find.
Pretty high percentage, yeah. That's good. Well, okay, let's move on to the guy from a whole nother country, which is Carrington Vanston, the master of the raster. Carrington?
Am I the master of the raster? Excellent. I've always thought of myself more of as a bitmap, but awesome.
You're not a vector graphic kind of guy, are you?
No. I do have font smoothing, apparently. But
very nice.
Rounded.
Carrington with clear type.
Definitely rounded and oblique and all the other things, yes.
All right. And for our next co-host, we have to go all the way to another continent. So from Stockholm, Sweden, we have Jack Nutting. Jack, tell us what's going on in your neck of the woods.
Well, I feel like I'm living in a bit of an alternate reality over here because we've actually had really good weather for the past month or something. It's been crazy. I've been lying out in the sunshine. I have a tan like you would not believe. It's incredible. It's amazing. I've been lying in the sun. I've been eschewing all of my retro computing activities that I should have been doing because I've been lying in the sun.
I think that's a good thing. The weather's nice. Get out and get some nature. You know, we've had unseasonably nice weather here in Portland, too. During the month of May, you almost wouldn't know that it was a May in the Pacific Northwest. It's more like summer came early. Spring just got skipped altogether.
Yep,
in fact, yesterday, I was out running around. Bunch of us were out playing miniature golf. That's a humbling experience. But, you know, it was 80 degrees and sunny and gorgeous. And I don't know, but I'll take it.
Global warming for the win.
I guess
we're
so.
All going to die.
But we're going to have some sweet weather before we do.
We will, and a nice tan. Yeah, very good. Well, so I wanted to talk today about alternate universes, because, you know, that goes along with being a retro computer enthusiast slash sci-fi nerd slash, you know, whatever. And I've thought an awful lot about this and really haven't come to many satisfying conclusions. So I thought I would drag in a bunch of really smart, really forward-looking people to talk about this, but they weren't available. So I thought I'd go with you guys instead. And why don't we start in the same order? So here's the question I'm going to pose to you. Imagine an alternate universe, right, in which Atari, Commodore, Sinclair, Apple, somebody besides Microsoft and Intel had become the predominant computer architecture. Like, you know, if you go today to buy a PC, the vast likelihood is that you're going to get a computer with an Intel chip and running Windows. There are other choices. Some people do choose the other choices, but the big belly of the bell curve goes with that particular combination. So I'm wondering, how might computing have looked different all the way back to the 80s and up until today, and maybe even on into the near future, if one of the other players had actually gained that market share foothold and had become the de facto computing standard. So I'll start with you, Paul. What do you think about this?
Yeah, it's a pretty difficult question. I know that at least the Apple III almost made it. I mean, like, I know that they were sort of rushing to get that in before the PC took over, and I think if it hadn't flopped so badly, you know, it could have taken that spot. But where that goes from there, I have no idea, because I have a hard time imagining the Apple III taking over. But yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know if it's fair, but I have this kind of feeling like if we didn't have Windows, we would have a lot less viruses and things. I mean, it probably isn't quite fair, but there was kind of like a philosophy behind Microsoft that I think contributed a little bit to that, you know, sort of like rush, get it out, you know, never mind about the art sort of stuff. If it works, it's fine. If it's usable, that's a bonus. But I've never been much of a Windows fan. So in a sense, like, I have this kind of feeling like it couldn't have been that much worse.
But well, philosophy, that's an interesting piece when it comes back around to me, because I think the corporate philosophies of the different players back in the 80s might speak to or inform what a computing landscape might have looked like under their leadership. So, and like you say, Microsoft was kind of it might be put together with Rust and bubblegum, but it does the job, and we're going to get it out there, and that's what we got. So
there definitely were some things that were ahead of their time, you know, that, but some sort of combination of mismanagement or whatever, you know, and inventiveness wasn't found in the proper place. And so somebody else could take off. I think if a proper business person had been paired with Commodore or Atari or something, you know, that to sort of like, take advantage of what the innovations were there, you know, like Amiga, everybody talks about the Amiga, that could have gone somewhere, but it seemed like it kind of hovered slightly below perception for a lot of people. So I don't know. I feel like, let me pass this on to the next person while I ponder this some more.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair enough. Carrington, what do you think about this?
It is a tough question, because you look back on how history unfolds and you assume, well, it had to go that way. Everything seems inevitable just because it happened, which explains a lot of how people in my demographic are crappy. But if we're thinking about, like, okay, like we were saying before we start recording it, like an elegant operating system for a more civilized age, and like, what could it have been? Like, if the Sinclair had taken over, then I guess Hot Pink and Cyan would still be seriously in vogue. But it's hard to see how, like, I don't think Wintel really did take over. Like, one of the things here is we're really just talking about, like, what the mass people would use for their personal operating systems at home. Because I don't know that Windows was ever the dominant computing platform if you look at all things that are computers. And probably some form of embedded system, like, is actually the operating system that dominated the 80s and forward. Things in watches or stoves or telephone things or the stuff that changes street lamps or whatever. And I suspect that, but if we're just looking at, like, what would have been mass adopted by humanity, essentially, and for kids to use and for people to use in businesses, it was going to have to be some sort of GUI. I mean, my family even now couldn't use an Apple II, and it's hard to get them to use a Macintosh correctly. So it had to be something that was brain dead simple. And I think the simplicity of, I mean, the apparent simplicity until it all collapses of a GUI was going to be necessary. So I don't see that the Atari operating system or the Apple II, just like the plain DOS or ProDOS or Sinclair or Commodore or any of them could have become the massive hit, essentially, that Windows was without adopting something considerably different. So it would have to have been something like GSOS. We mm-hmm. could have gone a different timeline and Apple could have played its cards differently. And maybe that could have been the way the Apple II would have taken over. Or maybe it would be some sort of layer on top of CPM. I could have seen, because like so much of it with Windows, I think was businesses leaping on and pretending that games wasn't important, but really it was all about the games. And so maybe CPM gets a nice graphics layer and a bunch of games, maybe, but then you know what? Maybe desktop Linux would be amazing. Like it's just, I don't know. It's hard to see how any of these things. So I'm going to say that GNU would have taken over and all our lives would have been terrible. It would have been like a scene out of Brazil or something.
I'm so frantic with this.
I mean, I was
editor.
Never a Windows person, so it never really affected me other than having to deal with other people using Windows. So maybe my life would have been better. Other people would have used something different that I didn't use. How would that have affected me? I don't know. Maybe a Radio Shack should have taken over. They had business stuff. What was wrong with them? Why did they do so poorly? What's wrong with you, TRS-80?
And in the little intro that I made, I forgot to mention Tandy, but, you know, there's just a whole laundry list of models and manufacturers you could go through. So definitely no slight intended there, and you're right. Radio Shack had made quite a play for the business world. They had their TRS-80 Model 2 computer that they jumped in with, aimed squarely at business, and that wasn't the last machine that they did that with. But just nobody was able to beat the juggernaut that came out back then. So
because like more and more as I think about like windowing operating systems, they all seem to eventually just be knockoffs of Windows, which yeah and then there's the argument that it's a knockoff of Mac or whatever, but that kind of hey, here's how we're going to do it. And I think if it was going to be that, it was going to be something either very similar to that, in which case it makes no difference, or something different than that in a way that I can't imagine it. Like, I can't imagine, like, no, it was going to be totally different. And there wasn't a mouse. There was just a keyboard and you shrugged your shoulders or something, or the menus were on the left-hand side, or eye tracking, or, because if it's just going to be, oh, it was a version of AUX or whatever. Well, it's basically Windows on a different computer. So they're all kind of the same. I don't know. Give me the Apple II and I was happy. But I don't think that could have ever taken over. I don't think it could have been popular the way Windows was popular. Like it couldn't have had 20 times the market share that it did. It just was frankly too complicated. I still don't know how to use ProDOS. So like, come on.
Interesting. Well, Jack, what are your thoughts?
I've been thinking about this as you guys have been talking, and I started thinking about, so Wintel, the reason that Wintel became the juggernaut it became was I think people were eased into that because there was a huge mass of both personal and especially business customers who were using DOS. And so the step from DOS to Windows, I mean, it was an evolutionary step. You could still run your DOS software in Windows. So like for business, that was the reason why that won over things, because they were already using DOS. And that stems from decisions made at IBM in the late 70s and early 80s. I started thinking, okay, what if IBM had a different decision point? Because I think the reason people began adopting that so much was because of IBM. I think without IBM having launched the PC and boosting Microsoft by including DOS with that, like things could have gone a whole different way. So because I think that prior to IBM launching the PC, I think that most of our beloved machines are things that business in a broad sense saw as being toys. Like they're like, okay, we have these big mainframe computers and we have terminals connected to them. Why do we want to have desktop computers? Why is that even a thing? I think it wasn't until IBM started pushing this that business people began thinking, maybe this is something, you know, the old adage, no one ever got fired for buying IBM. So what if IBM had decided something different than their kind of boring IBM PC platform that they launched? And maybe think of, I've seen something, I don't remember the details, but back in the day there was something where there were some talks between IBM and Atari. And some of you have probably seen that there's a photo of a mock-up device that looks like an Atari 800 that is totally white, maybe has an IBM logo on it or something. Like they were talking about maybe taking the Atari 800 and rebranding that as an IBM product. And started thinking, okay, what if IBM had gone with that as something, you know, as before the PC even came out, they could have had this in 1979 or 80 or something. That would have actually taken things in kind of a different direction. They would have had a platform that was, from the start, much more limited in some ways. Like, the good thing of the PC was you could actually address a lot of memory with bank switching and stuff, which you could never do properly on the Atari. But it would have been better in some ways. I mean, certainly the Atari had better graphics and sound years before the PC did. And it would have been interesting if like, that partnership had been something, had been the seed of, you know, what if the seed of 80s business computing had not been Atari, or had not been IBM and Microsoft, but had been IBM and Atari, and maybe Microsoft too. Get DOS running in there. Like, it could have been interesting. I think they could have had, we could have seen more interesting PC hardware earlier in the timeline than we did. And probably Windows would have been a different sort of beast if it was not just IBM and Microsoft working on it. I think in the long run, maybe it wouldn't have made a huge difference, but I think we could have seen some things more interesting a little bit early on. Like, say that, you know, say that, again, and there's a lot of ifs here, if Atari had reasonable business people running the show, and, you know, and if they had made that deal go through with IBM and actually became partners on this thing, well, maybe they would have kept some of their good hardware people, and they would have evolved that machine into something more like the Amiga sooner on. You know, there are a lot of things that could have happened differently. But I don't know. It's fun to think about.
Well, I mean, part of the reason that I think about it is, and you alluded to this, Jack, and I guess you guys all talked about the computers in the mid-80s. And, you know, I remember when the Mac came out that it had some competition in what I would say was lower-end space, in that in the mid-80s you had the Macintosh come out, but you also had the Atari ST line come out, and you had the Amiga come out. I think it's kind of fascinating that all three of those machines were based on Motorola processors and not the Intel processor. And yet, and, you know, by most people's calculations, the 68000 was a superior chip to the Intel 8088. Just more forward-looking, better architecture, none of this weird segmented memory access. And yet, the machine that actually won the day remained the Intel machine and its subsequent generations, the 286, 386, 486, that kind of thing.
No spoilers.
Yeah, exactly. If you haven't read ahead, you know, that's what ended up happening. And at the time, I was working in corporate aerospace, and I was thinking, wow, for every Mac that I buy, I could actually buy three of the Atari STs, or, you know, maybe two of the Amigas. I could have more computing power, and we'd have color. And, you know, it just seems like these machines have a lot of the same intrinsic capabilities of a Macintosh. But yet, you wouldn't even dare to bring up the idea of, let's buy Ataris for corporate America, or let's buy Commodores for corporate America, because you would have been shot down immediately. We had a hard enough time getting any Macs in the door. And I imagine that that was the case with a lot of corporations, like that adage that you mentioned, nobody got fired for buying IBM. It was very much true in the 80s. Here's kind of a slant on this question. So let's say that IBM, like you were saying, Jack, let's say they hadn't entered the picture the way they did. And now you're in the mid-80s, and your choices for business are the Mac or the Atari ST or the Commodore Amiga. Do you think that a winner would have emerged out of those? And do you think, up to and including today, that we would have more competition in the marketplace? Or do you think that still it would have been, you know, one computer to rule them all, that basically the industry would have picked an alternate player, and that would have become the standard? Or do you think that we might have still a little bit more diversity? Let me go around the table on that one. Paul, what do you think about that?
My guess is that we would still wind up with something that was pretty standard. You know, like something would wind up with 70% of the market share or something like that. I think once something gets past a tipping point and you're in businesses and stuff, they're just going to want to all be able to talk to each other. I don't know what it would be, but I do kind of wonder what it was about the Mac that made it do that, you know, that made it take over past. I really just think it must have been sort of bad business decisions on the competitor's part, because they had color, you know, they had, what they didn't have was a package that was all in one and a good, you know, advertising agency.
Right. Well, and all the momentum that Apple had still, even back from the Apple II days, yeah. Apple was still a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
And a lot of funding from the Apple II days. Yeah. They had just started up as a startup with the Mac. Like, we probably, none of us would have even heard about it. Mm. They had a lot of momentum and a lot of economics behind it to prop up the Mac, mm-hmm. and push it and push it and push it until it was successful.
So, Carrington, do you think they would have won that battle? Let's say IBM had just been weirdly subtracted from the universe, and you had the first GUI computers in the mid-80s.
Apple wouldn't have won with the Mac because they were too focused on high-end stuff, which is totally fine, but they have these blinders on with, like, nobody wants to buy a computer for $500. And just there was going to be a massive chunk of the market they were not going to even go for that would have necessarily been a void filled by somebody else, which ends up being 80% of the computers sold. And I agree with Paul that there was going to be a winner. I think there had to be an operating system that most people use, because everybody wants interoperability. You want to be able to take your floppy disk and walk it into somebody else and it still works. So maybe if there had been like a Microsoft juggernaut that was either open source or equal on all platforms, so everybody said, I don't care what computer you're using, this is like, these are the 10 things that everybody wants to do on it, and everybody uses the Microsoft suite, and it's all the same file format everywhere, and everybody adopts like a disk format that's the same. So then it wouldn't matter what computer buy, but then it's hard to see, like, how do we separate that from the operating system? So I really think there was going to be one winner, and I don't think it was going to be Apple.
Fascinating.
I made that choice. I leapt on the Mac. Mm-hmm. Kind of abandoned my Apple II and leapt on the expensive Mac stuff, and I really liked it. But I saw how compromised it was, and I was really fortunate that through business I could get them. I was fronting that bill myself. There's no way I could afford them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how most people have been. So I think somebody else with a better business head and a more broad market attack would have won instead of Apple. Apple was going to languish in the 5-8% market share range, I think, no matter what.
Huh. Well, Jack, why don't you close us out? What do you think about that? And also, I'm interested if you agree that, you know, it would have been one to rule them all, or we would have possibly, we have seen some more diversity in the marketplace up to now.
Well, I think it probably would have been one winner. I think because we had this problem all the time in the 70s and the 80s, where, you know, just as simple as floppy disks. Like, so you were talking about, sure, the Mac and the Amiga and Atari ST all had the same CPU, right? And they all had the same physical floppies, which none of them could read each other's formats at all. Like, there was just like, it was there, like, no one could agree on anything. This issue of standards, like, even as simple as that, sure, well, like, you can, the same physical floppy disk you can buy, but then no one can read it on each other's things without a lot of extra expensive hardware. And I think that Carrington has a very good point about the Mac being too expensive, and this was my take already in the 8-bit days. Like, wow, the Apple II is wildly expensive compared to the Atari 800 and the Commodore 64. And the argument that I got from my Apple II having and loving friends was, well, but it's an open platform, because look, you can open it up and it's got slots and I can install whatever I want in this. And I think, like, at the time, I didn't appreciate that at all. It didn't seem like anything to me. But I think there was something to that. I think that same thing is part of why the IBM PC was the success that it was that even as kind of like bare bones and limited as it was, it meant that someone else could create a better graphics card and could create network cards and different hard drive interfaces and all that kind of stuff. And you could sort of build it out into something that you wanted to do. And of the three Motorola-based platforms, the only company that was ever doing that was Apple with the Mac later on. Not the first Macs initially, but obviously that like the Mac 2 and on, they all had various configurations of slots and things, right? So I think they were the only ones who were sort of chasing that down. But that may have been they were chasing that down because they saw that that's what, you know, that's what IBM had done and was doing all the time, all the PCs were doing. So it seemed like a way to go for more high-end machines.
I completely agree.
I think there would have been a winner. I don't know if it would have necessarily, if that thing of moving towards open, an open platform in some sense that the that Mac eventually did would have made it that, or if it would have been, you know, something more along the lines of, oh, well, like say the price point, you know, you can get an Amiga or Atari ST for half the money or a third of the money that does equal and better in all regards. So I don't know. It's really hard to say. I remember, cause I remember at the time I went from Atari 8 bits to briefly have an Atari ST for just a year or two, and then moved on to the Amiga from that when I saw how much better that was for, you know, what I didn't, it's interesting because at the time I thought, well, I guess these are about the same, you know, the Atari and ST and the Amiga, they seem similar-ish to me, and I'm already doing Atari stuff, I'll go with that. But then once I had it and then started looking at the Amiga, it's like, that is just leaps and bounds beyond what I can do with this. And to me, it was frustrating at the time in 1990 and whatever to think that I was sitting on this thing that I was using all the time, that I could do things that no one else in home computing was able to do. But it was just it was like Paul said, it was like just under the layer of visibility. Like people didn't even know it existed almost. Like you had to go to weird specialty stores to even buy an Amiga. It was just like And it's I think it's just, you know, just bad business decisions, bad business people. And so there again, there that made the be the thing that would have been to Apple's advantage, because as you guys are saying, they had momentum from the Apple II, they had money from the Apple II, they had business savvy, they had marketing savvy. So the Mac may well be where it would have landed.
And Steve Jobs made a lot of deals with like demons. So so there's that.
There's that.
Interesting. So what? See, you guys are so insightful. This is why I love talking to you guys. So
I think Jack made a really good point though about the expandability. It's something I hadn't considered, but like that was a big thing, because computer obsolescence was like a big deal, and computers were expensive. So the Wintel juggernaut being able to say, hey, you can buy this computer and you'll be able to change it and expand it, was a massive advantage. And especially if you're selling into corporate culture, even if it's a big old lie and all it means is nothing's compatible and it's a big pain and you're going to upgrade everything anyway. But the idea that, oh, you can just pop in more RAM later, or you can put in a different hard drive later or add a hard drive later, you can change things. Like the more socketed and the more slotted something was, the better. Mm. And Windows had that as, I think, a big advantage early on. I mean, compact and stuff, all the knockoffs also helped. And I think the fact that they then started, like, it was the way that there wasn't a Macintosh licensing thing for quite a while. Like, you couldn't get a Mac other than through Apple until that bit where they started playing with power computing and licensing the operating system when Jobs was away for a while. But, I mean, that's the thing that Microsoft might have fought against, but happened with compact and with the whole, like, here come the clones. And that just, I think, would have happened with whoever became dominant. So I think if it wasn't Windows and if it was instead Amiga, which would have probably, the world would have probably benefited, there would have probably been Amiga knockoffs, or there would have had to have been Amiga knockoffs or Amiga clones to give it the ability to sell in lots of different market shares and market points and price points and all that. So I think there still would have been one winner.
You know, that openness and expandability that you're talking about, it wasn't just a myth either. I mean, I remember us buying 386 add-in cards that we could put in our PC XTs to take this XT that was an 8088 and now make it a 386. It wasn't as good as if you bought a 386 machine off the shelf, but it was a heck of a lot better than the 8088 that you started with.
Yeah, but cost-wise, a lot of times you do it because, okay, well, that's much better and I can't afford a whole new computer. But when you started looking at the cost of keeping that computer for a long time and doing all those upgrades, I would try to do that with my Mac and think, well, I can put a couple of them would come with, you know, a daughter card that had the processor on it. And it was so expensive to go and get an upgraded like PowerPC daughter card that I'm like, well, this is just crazy. I'll sell the existing computer and buy another one. And it's going to cost me the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So, what, you know, I'll close it out by talking about the philosophies that I alluded to earlier, the way I see it would have been different if it would have been another computer manufacturer or maybe multiples, but probably, I agree with you guys, it probably would have been one. I think the way the alternate universe would have been different would have been related to the corporate philosophies of the various companies back then. I mean, with Apple, you had elegance and style in the things that they produced, and very good engineering as well. So I think you're looking at more fit and finish in the way things would have turned out. With Commodore, they were always going for what is the most cost-reduced thing that I can do. And the Amiga's kind of an outlier in that, which is kind of strange. But, you know, the Commodore business philosophy, business is war, you know, basically take no prisoners, get out there and just make something and rush your engineers and that kind of thing. I'm not exactly sure what that would have looked like in the 90s and zeros and, you know, going forward if they had been the winner. Maybe they would have maintained that philosophy. I'm not sure what computer that means we wind up with using in a business context. But Radio Shack's the one that I just can't peg. If Radio Shack Tandy had won the business and then the home computing wars, I don't know where that would have taken us. I mean, maybe that would have even extended the life of the Radio Shack stores or something like that. But definitely, it would have been a different scenario than we have now. Anyway, I think the corporate philosophies would have made a big difference in what our computing life would have looked like, for better, for worse, for different, for sideways, that kind of thing. And that's probably beating that topic to death. So why don't we move on to listener feedback? Paul, do you want to take us through what we're hearing from the folks out there?
Sure. Yeah, I can do some of these at least. So let's see. We have, first one is from Alan, who sent an email, and so last time we talked about the Chess Challenger, I think Carrington had picked the Chess Challenger as one of the eBay auctions. And so what Alan wrote to us to say is that the computer listed in the auction that we mentioned last time was not, as it turns out, the first Chess Challenger 1.
Nope.
But which is indeed quite collectible, as Carrington had imagined, and can sell for $300 to $350. I don't remember what the auction was for, but it was I think it was more than that, wasn't it?
It was quite a bit,
yeah.
And I thought it was the one, but it was not the one.
Yeah.
There's so many slight variants early on.
Yeah. So the identifying mark was that there was a 12-key keypad, but it turns out that the Chess Challenger 3 also had a 12-key keypad and is hardly worth more than $50. So it does sort of feel to me like this points to the importance of being an expert. Like you really, you know, once again, weird grandpa's weird attic, you know, you find this thing and you look on eBay and you say, like, all right, what's this worth? What should I list it for? And there's so many little details that you'd only know if you were already an expert. So, but anyway, the way to distinguish a Chess Challenger 1 and a Chess Challenger 3, it turns out that the designer of the Chess Challenger 1 didn't really know chess very well. So whoever it is inverted the column and row signifier. So the normal way that you write a chess, like a standard opening move, is e2, e4 to move the pawn. And apparently on this, the Chess Challenger 1, but not the subsequent ones, you had to type 5b, 5d instead, because it was, you know, the whatever their columns were numbered and the rows were lettered instead of the opposite way.
Because it would have taken so long to look that up.
I can't even imagine how that could have happened, actually. That's just insane. But anyway, so it was kind of interesting. But if you're looking for a Chess Challenger, it is, you know, it's a deeper topic than even we thought.
I still don't want one.
No, but they're cool. It's interesting. But yeah.
Absolutely. I like different type of computers. Yeah. I'm going to pick one today as well.
Fantastic. Quinn wrote about the Sinclair QL. She said she hoped I bought it, and I haven't yet. I'm still thinking about it. But last time we had an auction for a fairly complete Sinclair QL set. But the thing that I had called a cartridge, it turns out to be more interesting than a cartridge. It's actually a little tape loop drive. They're micro drives, and I guess they're a little bit like a disc in the sense that it cycles, you know, it cycles rapidly over and over again. But it's actually a tape and not a platter. So they play in one direction, but you can still get random access without needing to rewind by just like waiting a little bit until it comes back around. So it's kind of interesting. We'll have a link in the show notes to a page that has a deconstruction of the drive and a little bit of a discussion of how it works and stuff. You can see little pictures.
Yeah,
of
I thought
it.
That was really cool. I had never heard of that. I mean, I've heard of continuous loop tapes before, mm-hmm. but I didn't know about these little micro drives. And that's a really neat sort of something that sits between tapes and discs, like to have something that's actually a tape, but every 8 or 12 seconds or whatever just is running through a loop, so you can do random access. That's mm-hmm. that's kind of cool.
And they are, for Sinclair, they were cheaper than any drives at the time, any floppy drives at the time. So this was kind of a compromise. They wanted to be able to get this out to the people, but they didn't want to have to charge as much as they would need to in order to have them be drives. So there was, I saw at some point, you know, like an interview with, I don't remember what the show was even, but it was sort of, the question was essentially like, why are you introducing this thing without disk drives? Everybody wants disk drives. And the person said, yeah, it's, you know, disk drives are faster, disk drives are better, disk drives are way more expensive. So we went with these.
It's kind of like a tiny little 8-track cassette kind of thing. Although I guess, is it just like, those have kind of a spiral of some kind, right?
The micro drive?
I'm thinking about the old 8-track audio cassettes. Because those are also looped. There's no, you don't need to rewind. Mm-hmm. You can just let it go and go and go.
Yeah.
I think those are similar. But I think those are kind of like the tape's on like a weird spiral-ish sort of loop of some kind. I think. I'm not sure.
Well, it would have to do something to be able to fit a big long tape in a relatively small package.
Right.
Yeah.
It's gonna have to loop or spiral or something.
Yeah.
Or I guess the whole point is multiple tracks.
Yes.
In the name.
Right. Right.
There,
well, yeah, I mean, so presumably there's some kind of sort of like, if you're looking at the tape flat, it's got to be some sort of vertical stepping that gets you from track
right.
to track. But there's still got to be, it's still got to be kind of a lot of tape in there. Although 8-tracks,
yeah.
I think, must move pretty slowly because they are pretty low fidelity.
Mm.
But yeah, why was there not an 8-track data cassette? That would have been kind of cool. Just tape over your Conway Twitty or whatever it is.
Never. So if we're imagining an alternative universe, then yeah, absolutely. This weird fantasy computer we're going to make up that takes over the world should absolutely have used like a front-loading 8-track tape
yeah.
as its storage device. That would have been awesome.
Yep.
And eventually you'd have dual ones, so you've got like 4 tracks of data and 4 tracks of Conway Twitty.
Yeah.
Okay, so I found an image. So the 8-track audio cassette did have a big spool that all the tape is on, and then like... from the middle of the spool is where it kind of unrolls and comes back out to play. So it rolls onto the loop from the outside and unrolls from the inside. Man,
wow.
That's crazy.
That's amazing that didn't jam.
Yeah, exactly. I can't believe that worked.
Oh, I found an image too, and it shows the best of Merle Haggard.
There we go.
So I'm fully on board with all of this.
All right. I forget. Was it last time we were talking about the eBay packaging problems? But maybe two times ago. But we got a couple horror stories in email. Gordon wrote to talk about a sad story of buying an ultra rare Nintendo NES robot, which was shipped to the U.S. I think it was shipped to the U.S. from Australia. But I wrote it wrong in the notes. But at any rate, it traveled that distance, and the seller, in writing the address down, put an extra digit in the street number. So it went all the way, you know, one way and then all the way back. The seller got it back, sent it again. And this time it was just lost in the mail. So very sad story.
That was not meant to be, apparently.
No. It's frustrating when it's something that is that rare, though.
Yes, indeed.
And then Tony wrote over email, actually, a very long, extended discussion about this, but he bought a rack mount synthesizer and programmer, and it's like 2 relatively heavy pieces, and wrote, you know, ahead of time to implore that it be packed very well. And apparently the seller at least claimed it was professionally packed by a shipping company, but it wound up coming in a flimsy box draped in bubble wrap with some padded envelopes as padding and just really, you know, very poorly packed and turned out okay, you know, mostly. Only a couple of sliders were slightly bent, although, I mean, it could have been a complete disaster because there's a lot of protruding knobs and things like this on this thing. So if it really was professionally packed by a shipping company, and it might well have been, you may not be able to trust a shipping company to professionally pack something, is I think the bottom line. If for something like this, it might actually be better to just tell someone, this is how you do it. Like, you know, wrap it up in a box inside of a box inside of a box.
Inside of an enigma.
Exactly. okay. Let's see. I'll go through a couple more. Mackay wrote it over email to point out just sort of a brief mention. He said that Henry Rollins, you people might know, I don't know. Anyway, he used a Mac SE and mentioned it. He mentioned it in a video tour of his house. And so there's a little link to YouTube link to like the exact moment when he says something like, and here's the trusty Mac SE. And that's pretty much all you want to watch of that video. The rest of it is quite dark, both before and after. But he does say he utters the words, that's my trusty Mac SE, and gestures toward the computer. Brian wrote over email. Actually, this one's pretty interesting. He wrote to point out the existence of a new Model F keyboard project. It's at modelfkeyboards.com. And this is a project replicating the old IBM Model F keyboards and having them manufactured new. So you can order them. The orders are being taken until June 30th. And there's going to be one production run, so you have one shot at this. They cost somewhere between $325 and $399, depending on like the options and stuff. So that looks pretty interesting. It's I don't know if anyone of you had a chance to look at this page. It's I think it would be kind of cool, but it's a serious commitment to pay that much for the keyboard. But they really do look like very nicely made. That's the idea, is like a keyboard that will last you decades. We'll see if that happens. But
yeah, it looks pretty amazing. Very expensive, but looks amazing.
Yeah. I don't know if I believe it, but the it says something like, you know, 10,000 sold or, you know, like pre-ordered or something like that. So it's a big project.
I mean, you probably wouldn't pay that much for something like this unless you were going to really actively use it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you probably wouldn't pay that much and just put it on a shelf. You would pay that much if this was the keyboard that you wanted as your primary interaction with your computer, and darn it, this was just the style that you preferred, and you're going to have one.
Mm-hmm. Though the page actually does talk about, you know, there's some discussion about what's good about using a mechanical keyboard and like why you would want to use one for real. So yeah, I mean it's although it does look fairly vintage, it doesn't look enough like anything that you would really want to display it. You really would want to use it.
So I found, I use a mechanical keyboard on my desktop, and it's so much better than the spongy keyboard I was using before, and it's a bit of an expensive keyboard. It's one of these Corsairs with a nice solid metal base and mechanical keys and that kind of thing, so you'll pay a little bit more for something like that. But one thing that I found is this is one of your primary interfaces to the computer. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you use it for hours and hours every day. And if you're going to get that much use out of something, it might as well be pleasant to use as opposed to just mediocre or at worst, you know, kind of frustrating to use. It's really worth it to pay a bit more and have a really great keyboard. In this case, it would be more than a bit more. It'd be maybe double more. But still, if that's the kind of key switch and the style of keyboard and everything like that you prefer, you miss it from the past and you wanted to have this, I could see doing that. I know it's a lot of money, but it makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same kind of argument you can make for having like a good chair. You know, it's like if you're going to be sitting here for so much of your life, might as well just spend a little more on it.
And I have two of these Kinesis ergonomic keyboards, and those cost around that amount of money. So, I mean, there are plenty of keyboards that people buy that cost that amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
So, not unheard of.
Yeah.
I just think that if I would buy this and like take it to the office, like I would drive everyone crazy.
Yeah, I was trying to... that's the thing, is it probably works best in your home office because it right. They are not quiet.
No. It's like I'd be called into the boss's office pretty quickly. It's like, Jack, we have a problem here. We've got some complaints.
Yeah.
It's not you, Jack. It's your keyboard. Buckling springs.
All right. I think I'll leave the feedback at that point.
Okie doke. We're jumping into the items of interest and news, and I'll talk about one. This is a few months old, actually, from back in August of 2017, but we never covered it. And it's about a senior at the University of Minnesota Duluth that, and I take it was for some sort of school project or whatever, restored a DEC PDP-12 computer. And I won't steal the thunder of the article. We'll have a link to the Duluth News Tribune in the show notes. But a couple of highlights of this. One of the things that I love that he says, because there's a little video there that you can play, and he indicates that he really likes this computer because you can understand what's going on. You can see the bits. You can see the ones and zeros on the console and flip the switches, and that have a very low-level understanding of what's happening with that computer. And they restored it beautifully, and it must not have been in that bad shape to begin with also, because if you look at one of the other highlights for me of this was that wonderful lime coloring that DEC used on this PDP-12 console. The industrial design of this, I think, is gorgeous, and I love those toggle switches. And also, you see some youngsters that are playing on it. I guess they're playing a game of Space War.
Nice.
And so, you know, you're introducing not only this university senior to this historical technology, but even a next generation after that. So I thought it was a fun article. It was a nice piece, and, you know, nice that they did a good job and even got some additional help restoring this PDP-12.
Yeah, I really like the look of these things. I mean, just the color choice. DEC made some really good decisions on their what do you call it, palettes.
Yeah.
They did.
Both that and like the orange and the PDP-8E that we used to mess around with. That was like, yeah. It was really, really nice. Like the orange and brown tones, and here you've got the green and a bit of like towards yellow. It's mm-hmm. very nice.
And there's a like a pink purple one too. I forget exactly like, you know, what it is that differentiates what, like why you have those different color schemes, what they mean, which models they go with, but they're all fantastic.
You know, it might be worth looking into to see if they actually hired an artistic consultant on those color schemes. I'm thinking even of the blue that they used on the VAX series of computers was a little less psychedelic, I guess, than some of these other colors that they used. But even it was a beautiful shade. It just, you know, very pleasant to look at.
Trying to keep all the programmers sane.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Very calming colors. Like, you know, I understand that it just crashed, but stay calm.
Just look at this calming color on the side of the box.
Yeah. There's a kind of a cool video interview, I think, with the person who made the Mac startup chime or whatever. But you know, part of the concern was that you want to have a sound that's kind of calming, because usually when you heard it, your computer just crashed and you lost everything. So you want some sort of like soothing sound when it starts up.
That's a good point. Jack, it looks like you've got some Atari news for us.
I do. And it's not, you know, as with all things of new Atari, it never feels like it's good news.
Aww.
So they were talking about this new console for a while. They've been talking about it, called the Atari Box, which a few weeks ago they decided to rename the Atari VCS, just like their original video game system was called. Which is very confusing.
I was
going to
say, good thing that there'd never been one of those before.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're launching this. They have it up on Indiegogo. They've raised $2.4 million. It comes with what looks like a modern controller, what looks like a kind of an old Atari controller revamped. And I just think, I don't know, I'm just so skeptical about this thing at all. Like, I guess they're going to make it, and I guess they're going to sell it. And it runs Linux, and they'll have some classic games and stuff. And I'm just so doubtful of the utility of this. I think the device costs $229. You can get it $199 without a controller, $229 with a controller. And I don't know. I just feel like I feel super doubtful that it's going to be interesting or useful for almost anybody. But like the one, there are some good things, right? So Jeff Minter, the crazy old guy who started doing stuff in the 8-bits era and has been making game stuff forever with LlamaSoft, he's got a game launching on it called Tempest 4000, building on his other Tempest games. That's really cool. That's super exciting. But otherwise, I just feel like, I don't know, man. I'm just full of doubt. Like all the classic games they talk about, we can play those anywhere, anytime, on anything. We don't need a console for that. And in terms of the specs of it, I'm no expert on PC graphics hardware, but most commentary I've seen has said, well, this is not even like a mid-level laptop from a year ago, spec-wise. Like it's nothing that will compete with the PlayStation 4 or the Xbox One. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
One wonders what they... I mean, like, maybe they just should go off in an entirely new direction, but I don't know what they could do. What would be the good version of what they do? I guess is the question.
Like, what did you guys think of the flashbacks? The various incarnations?
All right.
But they're cheap, too.
I have the portable one. I have the right. Flash, the 2600 portable one. And it's nice, and it was cheap. It was like, I forget what it was, $40 maybe or something at Target. And it's fun. I don't play with it a lot, but when I do, it's, you know, it works well and it's fun. You can sort of, you can pop in an SD card and play all the games you want. Any title for the 2600 will work on it. And I think, like, there is a possibility here. Like, if they make it so that it works kind of like, you know, if it makes it easy and relatively inexpensive to, you know, have, with a simple sort of point-and-click interface, say, yeah, I'm going to grab Tempest or, you know, grab Sword Quest or Combat or whatever to play one of these old games, and, you know, it costs $2 or whatever it costs. I think there is an argument to be made for the correctness of doing that in terms of, like, they could actually try and make deals with, you know, make a deal with whoever owns the other old games to actually give them a bit of money. Because right now we can play retro games all day long and no one earns anything from it.
Right.
Whereas if someone could possibly sell fresh copies of River Raid from 1982 or whatever, like, great, that could be nice in a way. Like there's some sort of hygiene factor there in compared to what we're doing all the time, which is essentially just piracy, which is, no one cares. Piracy of old software no one cares about. There's an interesting idea here. I have no idea if Atari's going to try and do this or not. But I don't know. We'll see. I can't even say I'm optimistic about it. I'm cautiously curious. That's the best I can do.
And when's this scheduled to come out?
I'm not sure. What are they saying? So there's a month left on the Indiegogo, but it has already achieved its goal by far.
Oh, I see here. It says estimated delivery July of 2019.
Okay, there you go.
That's on the collector's edition.
Right.
I don't know if I scroll down on some of these others. What they all seem like they're saying July of 2019, so about a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. With a graphics setup that's about a year out of date already right now.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I think for certain kinds of gaming, and admittedly, the kind of gaming that I like to do most is classic retro gaming. Like, my needs don't... I don't need the newest 3D hardware, that sort of thing. But on the other hand, I can already play all those games today on my laptop. I don't need this. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or, again, on something like one of the old clone consoles, like the Flashback, where,
right,
you know, you're actually getting some games with the computer, right?
Yeah.
So...
So it'll be interesting to see where it goes. I guess with all things Atari nowadays, I'm just always skeptical about this company. But we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, the name's been bounced around kind of like the Commodore and the Chicken Head brand.
Yep.
Same sort of deal.
Yep.
So, Paul, we were talking about alternate universes before. It sounds like people are inventing some alternate universes, like maybe the 80s could look like this or could look like that. Is that what I'm getting from these fantasy console computer things that you're going to talk about?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So the Tezza sent an email that was sort of passing along an email that he received from Tony, who is the developer of something called Basic 8, which is a fantasy computer. And it says Basegate is an integrated fantasy computer for game and other program development. And it is essentially, it's creating something like an 8-bit computer that didn't exist but could have, or something like that. And so last time we actually talked about something called Phasic I.O., which is one of the things in this category. And we have a link, actually, we'll have the link in the show notes, to Fantasy Consoles Computers that includes a bunch of these things. So the Phasic I.O., also Pico 8, which we talked about at some point, because it's sort of counterproductively, I think, it's included as the at least as one of the options on the pocket chip. Jack, you have one of these, right?
Yep. Yeah, that's right. So you can, if you buy a pocket chip, it has Pico 8 pre-installed, which is cool, because otherwise Pico 8 costs, I think it also costs $15, like Basic 8 does.
Right. Yeah.
So it's kind of nice having it pre-installed in this. And you can actually, so you can use the pocket chip to program games in Pico 8. And I think it's, I think you program in Lua? I forget. I messed with it a little bit when I bought it and haven't touched it again. How sad.
Right.
But the idea is interesting. I kind of like this idea of having this artificially constrained platform where you just have a certain resolution to work with and a certain palette of colors, and that's it. But that otherwise you have potentially modern tools at your disposal. You can edit your source code and whatever you want, and then somehow bring it into this environment and compile it and run it. So you're not limited by working on a machine that is as limited as the target that you're running for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting.
Yeah. And I didn't realize that this was such a big thing, you know, that there were so many of this sort of project. But, you know, so I hadn't heard of Basic 8. We had talked a little bit about Pico 8 before, and we talked about the Phasic I.O., but there's, you know, there's a whole list of similar kinds of things. And at the bottom of the you know, like the Fantasy Consoles page, there's a little kind of like a FAQ or something that tries to define, I guess, what one of these fantasy consoles is. And it says it's fairly simple to tell if one is not a fantasy console computer by the following five things. Like, one, hardware, such as a Raspberry Pi or a Gameduino, are not. Emulators are not, like NES and Commodore 64 and DOSBox and things. General graphics libraries and game engines are not. Programming environments and editors are not. Minecraft is not. You know, so it's all these things that, like, they're not emulating something real. But the thing that I think is kind of weird about the at least Pico 8 specifically in the pocket chip is that they've kind of like then gone backwards. You know, Pico 8 was a virtual computer that didn't exist in any, you know, reality, and we're just sort of like fantasy programming on it. And now we've provided a hardware, you know, underpinning for it.
Right, which is pretty funny. But I think, so I've looked a little bit. So there is inside of Pico 8, there's kind of a browser that lets you download games online.
Mm-hmm.
And there are just tons, and there are so many games people have written. And I would guess that the vast majority of those are not written using a pocket chip. They're people doing it on their computer. The pocket chip is kind of taking that fantasy console and putting it into something concrete, which is interesting. But then also the pocket chip is a lot more things than that too. You know, it's a little Linux machine with a little screen and stuff that also just has Pico 8 as one of its pieces of software. So,
yeah. So Basic 8, Tony is the developer of Basic 8, and you can actually get that on Steam and just sort of install it on your computer. And I've gone that far. I've actually purchased via Steam Basic 8, and I haven't tried it out yet, but it's pretty cool. I mean, it looks like it'll be interesting to play with, and it's, you know, it works on, looks like, Windows and Apple and Linux and whatever this other icon is. So anyway, something to try if you didn't know about this, as I didn't, the wide variety of these fantasy consoles. It's worth taking a look at just to see if you want to play in some of them.
I think it shows, at least in a niche sort of fashion, that there's still interest in a programming and fun, just goofing around hacking environment that is more simplistic than what we have now.
Yeah.
You know, these things are intentionally, as you mentioned, low powered, constrained, but you can just kind of jump right in and do something fun with them, which I think is neat. So I guess we don't have Carrington back quite yet. So we were talking about Atari a little bit earlier. I have a bit of sad news to report. Ted Dabney, the co-founder of Atari and a video game pioneer, one of the pioneers of our industry, has passed away. He was 81. From what I understand, he passed away after a battle with cancer. We have a link in the show notes to an article about him and his tenure with Atari over on NPR.org, but I noticed that a few places carried this, including New York Times and some other news sources. And there were some details in there about Ted Dabney's time with Atari that I wasn't aware of. Like, I wasn't aware of how early, actually, in the history of Atari that he had bid his farewell to the company. Also, interestingly enough, it's more references to, I guess this kind of starts to really solidify the story that Nolan Bushnell and his buddies had had this dream of opening up a pizza parlor that was kind of, you know, this sort of party place, and of course wound up doing that later on with the Chuck E. Cheese chain of pizza places and animatronic attractions there. Mm. But anyway, again, a link to that in the show notes.
Attractions or nightmares, I don't know. But, yeah.
Chuck E. Cheese, yes. nothing feels better to a kid than having some giant undead thing start to move and make noise all on its own when they're not expecting it.
Yes.
It's charming.
I find it kind of unfortunate that I didn't really know his name prior to this. Mm. You know, like Nolan Bushnell's name is a giant one in the history of Atari, and Ted Dabney's name didn't register with me before. But I'm glad that at least, you know, like the article is there and recognizing his contributions now.
Yes, it was some history I wasn't aware of as well. And it's a shame that sometimes we only find out about these things when somebody has passed away or something untoward happens. But I'm with you, Paul. I'm glad that some of that history was out there in the mainstream for people to understand his contribution.
Yep, and I came across somewhere, I'll try and find a link for it to include in the show notes. Benj Edwards had a really good article he wrote a few years ago about just the early years of Atari, describing how these guys worked together and how things started up. Gives a bit more detail about this. So I can try and find that.
Yeah, that'd be great if we could have a link to that. So, Paul, you're up next with Eudora and more joyous source code, I guess, huh? This is a good thing.
Yeah. Carrington, are you back?
I am indeed.
Okay.
They can't keep me down.
Maybe why don't we go back and get Carrington's first thing, so we have to make sure we get the scooping of OpenApple implemented.
It is very important to scoop OpenApple. OpenApple came and tried to burn down my building during this conversation to stop me from scooping them. You can't do that twice, Quinn. I'm on to you.
Well, Carrington, you've got two in a row. Why don't you jump in?
All hits all the time on Carrington FM. So a tweet went out into the tweeting world a few days ago, about a week ago almost, 25th of May. John Keone Morris tweeted that he had just successfully imaged the floppy disks for the never-released version of Sword of Sonan for the Apple IIgs. Now, that's the first I heard of it, but I was coming in media res, as they say, because slightly before that, the story kicked off when Rich Walter posted on the Apple IIgs enthusiast group over on Facebook, which is a terrible place. The enthusiast group is good. Facebook is the terrible place. He posted that he had found the 3.5-inch disks that his friend Jimmy Huey had in storage for a couple of decades, and those discs contained the development version of the never-released game Sword of Sonan. There had been a demo that was out that got everybody excited, and there were ads in magazines, but the game never appeared. What had happened was Discovery, the company is the word I'm looking for, the company that was going to be producing and publishing the game, had needed a new developer. It was about 80% done or so, you know, give or take. New developer was coming on board, and so they sent the discs out to say, hey, here's a game that's mostly done. We're already advertising it. Can you complete it? The developer declined, and eventually Discovery just kind of abandoned the 2GS because they were moving on. And this is very late 80s, like 89, and so a lot of things were moving on. And then discs were never reclaimed, and they just sat in a closet or so for decades. Then they were found. How exciting. And so then they were sent over to John Morris, and they got imaged, and they are now available online, and it is a playable version of the game. It is incomplete, of course, but the code is there. It is now being, and there is no source code available, but of course, if there's a game, it can be decompiled, so people are going through it and trying to figure out what's involved. What will come of this? Who knows? Maybe the game will just always be incomplete, but there it is, a playable version, if incomplete at the moment. Maybe somebody will be able to step up and make it more complete, or who knows what will come of it. But it's one of those games that was very much looked forward to, and it was advertised, it looked great, and it did come out on a bunch of other platforms, just not for the 2GS. And now it has kind of come out for the 2GS. And the most I think amazing and impressive and exciting part of the whole news story is that we're announcing it before Open Apple. And I think at the end of the day, that's all that really matters, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Take that.
It's really cool, though. So I think it's pretty amazing when a game like this gets released that had, you know, people were excited about it decades ago. And then it's like, oh, hey, here it is.
Found it.
Yeah, not complete, but still pretty awesome.
I still occasionally marvel at the fact that something like this can actually get out to the public. I mean, in the time when this was made originally, you know, if somebody found it in their closet, maybe gave it to a couple friends, you know, most of the world would not hear about this. But, you know, we're at a point where finding it in the closet means it can get out to everyone who might have an interest in playing this or might remember the ads or whatever.
Right.
So.
And Jimmy Huey, the developer that was, you know, had the stuff and had been given both the discs and the source code. They just haven't found the source code, but he and Rich Walter say they're going to be digging through closets and such to, and hopefully dig that up as well.
Cool.
And Carrington, you've got something on Virtual 2 also.
Oh, I got something on Virtual 2. It knows what it did. Virtual 2 is updated. And Virtual 2 is amazing. Like, Virtual 2 is just such a shockingly good emulator for the Apple II. If you're on a Mac, it's bonkers not to have Virtual 2. It is just, I've bought it multiple times because it gets upgraded, and it's so good that I'll just, you know, say, hey, let me just buy the license again. So I think I've bought it three times now. It's just so it's really that amazing. And they've announced, first, as of version 8.3, which came out not too long ago, it announced it now has WAS disk image compatibility, and 8.4 has just come out, and it has improved the WAS disk compatibility, which is pretty amazing. Like, the WAS disks are, that image format is making the rounds, and it's exciting that my favorite emulator is leaping on board.
Mm-hmm. What is a WAS file format for the uninitiated? What does that mean?
WAS was a fellow.
I've heard of him. Yeah. Yeah, he had something to do with Apple, if I remember.
And if you write in his blood, you get... it's the stuff from the scanning thing.
Applesauce.
Paul,
yeah.
What's it called? Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and I've never... I mean, by now, it's called applesauce. That was never my choice. Like, my vote was not for that. But at any rate, yeah. So I forget if we talked about this before. We must have. But applesauce is it's a little bit like the CryoFlux or the Disk Ferret or whatever the other is, SuperCard Pro. It takes a Apple II disk drive and sort of, you know, you latch on the applesauce thing to the Apple II drive. And then you plug that into like a USB, you know, so your modern computer can run the Apple II drive and it can sample the magnetic information at a super high rate. So the idea is that this is the way to get Apple II disks imaged in basically a perfect way so that you can. So what the,
gotcha.
The WAS format is it's kind of a condensed. So it's not actually a raw format. It is processed, but it contains all of the information. In principle, all the information that you could need for a copy protected disk. And so what Virtual 2 can now do is run copy protected disks without cracking them.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So this is like a magnetic level, high fidelity kind of approach as opposed to just like a track and sector sort of thing.
Right. The dot, what is it? A2, the A2R files are the actual raw one, I think. Isn't that the format? The WAS file is the one that has the timing bits and stuff.
This is basically, it's John Cuny Morris's project, and he's been working on this for probably a year and a half or something like that. But just recently, the Applesauce hardware is just about ready to go out. I think he's gotten the test units, and so it might be even available in the next couple of months. He's got a couple of people who are making lots of these WAS images of their own disks. He's got a couple sort of test units out there with people who have amazing collections of rare disks. And so this probably is going to be the near-term future, or, you know, like possibly the finishing of the, you know, Apple II archiving effort, just because, you know, this can get a very faithful reproduction, and all the bits are going to fall off pretty soon. So there's not going to be a chance to do a better one.
Great.
Very good. Preservation.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Oh, and the thing I was going to say about this is that John's actually been pushing this pretty hard among emulator writers. So he got Gerard Putter to put this in Virtual 2. I think MAME's just about to get it. He's basically tried to set this up in a way that it's pretty easy for emulator writers to at least process the format so that they can read. I think writing is probably more difficult, but he's definitely tried to engineer this in a way that it can get into as many emulators as possible for any emulators that are still being worked on.
Good.
So.
Anyway, I think it's very exciting news, and Virtual 2 just continues to get better.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good. It's already so good. It's already shockingly good.
Well, perfect. Well, Paul, why don't you close us out with some source code?
Okay, yes. So the Computer History Museum has announced that the Eudora email client source code is now available. So they've been working with, I don't know who they were working with, but, you know, the people who own Eudora, you know, Qualcomm, I guess, eventually. It is now possible to download the source code. And I think you're not allowed to do, it says something like you can't use eudora.com or eudora.org, but you can, you know, download the source code and work with it and conceivably, you know, update it if you want. But it's a pretty big thing. I don't know who among us used Eudora, but I did a lot, you know, basically until it stopped working. It's one of the biggest email clients that there was, and I think it had a big effect on just the whole space, because I mean, the, you know, it was one of the early ones, so the decisions they made about how the interface worked affected a lot of other competitors as well.
This is a very loved piece of software. I mean, if you looked at some of the conversations that happened over on the Classic Computing mailing list, mm-hmm. after this source code was released, people have mentioned that some of the user interface, what would you say, mechanics of Eudora, they haven't found in an email client since,
mm-hmm.
including all the modern day email choices that you have. So not only for the historic factor, but just, you know, the popularity factor, I think it's so cool that, you know, once again, the Computer History Museum has stepped in here and got some important source code released.
Mm-hmm.
I was a huge fan of Eudora. Like, I used it for ages back when I didn't hate email. Maybe I didn't hate email because of Eudora. Maybe the fact that I dislike it so much now isn't the fact that it's inherently awful. it's I don't like any clients. But I was a big user of Eudora for many years.
Yeah, I was pretty bummed out when it sort of stopped being possible to use it. It would be pretty cool if it were usable again. Now, I mean, now all the interfaces are everything in one window, hide all the controls unless you're actually hovering over the spot and stuff like that. And it's Eudora was very straightforward and quick.
Mm.
That's the other thing I don't like about my current mail environment, is that everything is very slow because I have, you know, 15,000 emails or something.
Well, things are just real heavy these days. I mean, it's definitely... Man. Murphy's Law.
Why are things so heavy in the future?
Well done.
Well done. Oh, my goodness.
Anyway.
And with that, I'm going to have us break for a word from our sponsor.
You sure about this?
Yep.
Well, here Here goes nothing. All right, we made it.
So this is the future?
The year 2015.
We haven't eaten in 25 years.
Pizza.
What about that place that delivers?
Yeah.
What happened to them?
What kind of future is this?
Yeah, there's no pizza anywhere.
What a drag.
Officer?
Where do you get pizza around here?
Turn around, guys.
In the future, like today, there's really only one place to get a great pizza. Pizza Hut.
Wow, nice look, guys. Very 80s.
Pizza Hut! Making it great!
Okay, Atari, let's see your best pitch.
You're out, Rose.
I quit soccer to play Atari.
You need more practice, Pele.
You can't keep me in here, Atari.
The Atari video computer system is 20 cartridges with 1,300 game variations you play on your own TV set. Don't just watch television tonight. Play it.
And we're back. To the future? Well, I guess so, because what I'm about to talk about on the host's retro computing gift idea is the future if you compare it to the past, which makes it now. And it's going to take some explaining. As Paul pointed out when he was looking at the show notes before we started the podcast, this isn't just like an Atari keychain or a t-shirt or something cool like that. It's a little bit more nerdy, so I'm going to have to explain this host gift idea, but it's called an RTL SDR. It's a software-defined radio. Put simply, it's a little USB stick about the size of a thumb drive that you connect into your computer and the other side connects up to an antenna, and it lets you listen to all the things. The beautiful part of a software-defined radio is that you can process all the radio stuff that's coming in with the computer, and you can decode it, demodulate it, all the things that let you get some meaning out of it. I mean, it's kind of amazing that as you sit in your home or your office, the number of signals, just radio signals that are in the air all around you, staggering. You know, it's got to be hundreds. I don't know.
Like we're leading up to a tinfoil hat thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure I like this. I guess it's like getting one of those things that make you grant permission on every internet connection that your computer makes.
No, not at all. I mean, so think about this. You got AM radio, you got FM radio, you got aircraft going over you, right? You got, you know, your ham radio stuff that's in the area. You've got...
aliens.
You do have aliens, yeah. Right. Definitely. I thought we weren't going to talk about the aliens, though. So this cute little... radio USB stick thing lets you listen to all that. There's lots of great software out there that will let you listen to the things of your choice. Like, you know, here's one interesting thing. When aircraft are going over, they're broadcasting like, hi, I'm this aircraft, I'm at this altitude, I'm going this direction. And it's just kind of fun to see those transmissions, maybe overlay them on a map. You can see what's going on in the air around you. That's one of the things. Another of the things I mentioned, the ham radio, lots of activity going on, especially in major metropolitan areas. You can tune into that with these USB sticks. It's like the super, incredibly capable radio that lets you tune into just about anything. It does have it, you know, frequency, range limitations and stuff like that, but it's $25. So it's $25 to get one of these, and they give you actually a couple different choices of antennas. They put it in a nice little shielded aluminum box. That's a tinfoil hat thing, by the way. And it's just so much fun. It opens up a whole nother realm of your exploring if you're into that kind of techie stuff.
It'd be cool if you could get it to tune into bands way beyond that, to up to like Wi-Fi or whatever. Because I used to, back in the 80s and the 70s, I could listen to a modem and tell what kind of connection it made. And now I can sit here and listen to like, ah, my neighbor's just logged into Facebook. I can tell from that sound.
And now I know their password.
I can tell it. I can sing their password.
So these guys here won't let you tune up quite that high because they top out at
man,
about
it's keeping me down.
1 point something gigahertz. But, you know, if you got one of these for $25 and you just go, I'm going to listen and I'm going to see, you know, what sort of things you can do. There are other choices of software-defined radios that go up into the hundreds of dollars, and they can get you up into those frequency ranges, into the Wi-Fi zone and that kind of thing.
You know, somebody like Quinn will be able to take this to Kansas Fest and say it's our fault for not having an air gap, and that's why she's been able to like get all our passwords out of the air from just listening.
It'd be kind of cool if you could listen in on, you know, like the deep space probes or whatever is there, or the little things sent out exploring the solar system.
Well, I don't know if you can listen to those, but you can definitely, with the right antenna, get satellite transmissions with these guys. So there's the NOAA weather satellite transmissions, and there's other, like, little CubeSat sort of, you know, lower cost satellites that are in orbit. And, yeah, you know, that's another thing. You got all this constellation of satellites going over your head at any given time. Well, you might not be able to receive those transmissions with the antenna that they give you for $25, because come on, what do you want? But you can get a better antenna and plug it into something like this and get satellite transmissions. Mm. So it's just a variety of things you can do with these things. They're so versatile, which is the giant word I was looking for before, that it, you know, and they've got a blog for these things where they talk about different types of radio transmissions that people are listening to with these. I just, one of my favorites is just my local, you know, public service kind of thing, like police, fire, medical, that kind of thing. But, you know, there's all kinds of other things depending on what you want to hear.
You can listen to, what are those things called? Number stations?
Oh, yeah.
The weird spy things. You can listen to those.
Right.
Letter beacons, like, you just, like, get all into
well,
it.
Well, okay, so, with the cheaper one, you couldn't, but with this $25 one, it actually does go all the way down into what they call the HF band, the shortwave band. Shortwave is where you're going to hear things like the ham radio, long-distance transmissions, number stations, shortwave broadcast stations, and that. But that said, this isn't a fantastic shortwave radio. If you want a shortwave radio, you can do much better than this. But the fact that, again, for $25, you could even listen down into the HF realm is amazing to me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this could be a gateway.
Right.
Like, if you might be susceptible to becoming a shortwave radio enthusiast, you could start with this.
Yeah. Or a ham radio enthusiast.
Yeah, it's a very
or,
low initial investment.
Right. Yeah.
Or like Carrington said, if, you know, you're a conspiracy theorist, one of these would be great.
I really like just the thought of how many data bits are flying, you know, into my brain at any given point is really kind of freaky, though. Like, I almost don't want to know.
Will our listeners be able to use this to find the signals we embed in this podcast?
Oh, no.
Because that can get us in trouble.
I hope not.
They might be, yes, and the backmasking. They can use it to reverse the backmasking. So cool. That's my gift idea, and you're stuck with it. I realize it's very propeller head, but by the same token, it's only $25, and it's a fun little toy. Mm. So, and now on to other things we can buy. Let's talk about eBay auctions. Carrington, what's your choice?
I am once again going to pick a computer that's not really kind of a computer. I'm totally on a kick with these things. So last time was the chess thing that I thought was original. It wasn't. This time I'm going to pick a horse race analyzer. So it's a little handheld thing that you can take to the track. And I like this one because it's from the late 70s and it's by Mattel. It looks like into the 80s and quite a bit on that into the 90s, I think. This exact thing was put out by other brands, and all it does is change where it says Mattel Electronics and puts Horse Race Analyzer in basically that same computer font. But it's more fun to get one by actual Mattel. So this is a 1979 original Horse Race Analyzer. And I like this one because it comes, you can get these very cheap. This is $20. And I guess what you're supposed to do is type into the little, it's like a little dedicated computer slash calculator. And you type in the stuff about the horses you're interested in. And then it tells you how to bet. And you're going to make millions of dollars. So like this is an investment in your future. Right. It's awesome.
You can,
and
so it's a, with your millions of dollars, you can afford to buy like 15,000 of these horse race analyzers.
Yeah. And what's fun is this one comes, I think it looks like relatively complete because you can get a lot of these as standalone, but it actually came with a little fold over case. And in that case would be the little, it's like a little booklet of paper and you're supposed to write down like the horse, the analyzed horse stuff. And so you draw on it and each race you rip that off and write on the next thing. And so of course you would eventually run out of this paper, but this one comes with the mail order form to order more from Mattel. So you can get another set of 12 horse race analyzer pads for only $4 a set. And I'm sure that those will still be honored by Mattel. So it's pretty cool. We go, as a family, we go to the track once a year, every year for Father's Day. My father passed away ages ago, and we still do it. I'm dating a girl who's into horses now, so she often tells me how it's awful that I'm going to the track, but whatever. It's a family tradition of awfulness. What else is a family for? So I really should pick one of these things up and then, you know, make my millions.
But if you retire, what are we going to do without you on the podcast?
If I retire, I'll just retire into full-time podcasting. So everybody wins / loses.
Excellent.
I'm looking at one of the boxes for at least, I don't think it's a Mattel one, but a similar one. It says, in a computer study of at a leading university on a sample of 946 races. Quick, pick a random sounding number, 946. This computer's top-rated horse finished first, second, or third 58% of the time. Asterisk.
60% of the time it works every time. So it's awesome. Anyway, I like this little thing. I see these on eBay all the time, but I didn't realize that Mattel made one, so I want to pick the Mattel one because I like Mattel. I have a soft spot for Mattel. And I'm going the full Paul. Well, I'm going the partial Paul, and I'm picking two different things. I added another one during this because I had all this time on my hands. But my building was burning down and my microphone was muted, so I went looking because we were talking about 8-track tapes, and I have picked a thing that I am sorely tempted to pick up to bring to Kansas Fest. It is the Omni Entertainment System by Milton Bradley. It is an 8-track tape-based entertainment system. So it's a big old box with four positions, and you plug in an 8-track tape, and it plays games. And it's mostly just quizzes. And it comes with a bunch of different ones. This one, it comes with a music quiz and a Sesame Street quiz. And the pack-in cartridge has a bunch of different games, including a trivia game that is voiced by Vincent Price. So you put it in, and Vincent Price will say trivia things, and then each of the four people are sitting in front of their own little station, and then you answer by pressing little buttons to see. I'm like, this just looks super 70s fun.
Oh, wow, cool.
Yeah. I hadn't heard of these things before. Amazing. But I seriously want one. Now, it's $500 US plus expensive shipping, but I think this would make Kansas Fest very, very fun. And then if I could figure out a way, if it's just 8-tracks, that means it's just voice, right? So I could make a new cartridge or something. Anyway, I'm sorely tempted to get one of these things. Now that I know it exists, I don't know if my life will be empty without it. So good chance I'm bringing one to Kansas Fest. So the Omni Entertainment System, 8-track based 4-player quiz show with Vincent Price. Come on. Can't go wrong.
This looks really cool.
Fantastic.
So
had any of you guys heard of this thing before?
No.
Nope.
No,
nope, me neither. And I want it. I want it bad. And this is a boxed one with a lot of carts. So,
though I'm trying to. So the way the word Omni is written, it feels like it's triggering some kind of like memory. And I'm not sure.
Omni magazine?
Yeah. Is it the? I think there was a car, and I think there was a magazine. And I'm trying to figure out like.
Oh yeah, there was a car. Yeah, there was also the Omni. I think it was a Dodge Omni.
Yes. Oh, and it was exactly the same as something else. Plymouth's Horizon, I think.
Okay. The Omni magazine used a very different font, though. It was that very squiggly sort of font.
Okay.
Like had a very unique Omni font that looked more like a radio signal coming in, kind of.
Right.
But this one with the slanty M looks very familiar. But
I can't.
Anyway, I want one. I want one very badly.
Yeah. Nice.
Cool.
This. I mean, the one you picked is super complete. I mean, yeah. My guess is that. It's probably the most complete one. I mean, like, it is expensive, but I can kind of understand it. It comes
yeah,
so
there's
much
another
stuff.
One on eBay right now that's $100 less, but only comes with a couple of cartridges. Like, you want to spend a bunch of time tracking these things down? I mean, could I live without the baseball quiz version? I don't think I could.
Now that you know it exists, absolutely
now
not.
Now that I know it exists, I must have it. I actually don't want any of this, but at Kansas Fest, this would be super fun. So, anyway, Kansas Fest. those are my choices.
Very good. Well, that's a tough act to follow, so I'm not even going to try. But I will talk about an auction that I saw here, just because there were, a couple of interesting things about this auction for a TRS-80 Model 3 and a 5-megabyte hard drive. And it comes with a key also, they say here. So that, you know, that's exciting, right? I guess it's the ignition key, right, for the drive, you know, vroom, vroom, start that baby up. So the machine itself looks pretty darn clean, as does the hard drive unit. The hard drive unit is maybe just a little scruffier, but still looks like it's in good shape. And they took lots of pictures, some of them on the tailgate of a pickup truck, which is definitely where I kept my Model 3 back in the day. So a couple of interesting things here. One is that the description has one word, works. I mean, there's a few other things in the description. You know, look at my other auctions. This is what, I'll take it to the UPS store. They prefer local pickup. This is in Lansdale, Pennsylvania. So if you're there, you would save the $130 that they're estimating it would cost to ship it to me, because if you don't pick it up locally, they're going to take it to UPS and let them professionally pack it, which, you know, might not be a bad idea, especially for these all-in-one computers.
You might want to watch them do it, though.
Yes, to make sure that they don't just throw a couple peanuts in there. Yeah. And yeah, the current bid, there's four bids, and it's up to a whopping $5.50. The other interesting thing about this auction was, again, we can see you, dude.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
You know, when you take a photo of a CRT and you're standing directly behind the CRT, you are taking a photo of yourself. So, you know, we're all waving hi.
Yeah. Happy anniversary.
Nice Model 3 you got there. Yeah, exactly. So, but, you know, if you're in the market for a Model 3, and if you want one that works. Works is a wide continuum, right, of possibilities.
Works as a computer, or just works as, things can work as a lot of stuff. Yeah, works great as a doorstop.
Yeah.
Right. So
works to hold down the tailgate of a truck.
It actually boots up from a floppy disk, boots up from the hard drive. That's one definition of works. You know, I turn it on and I see the LED illuminate. That's another definition of work. So if
has pickles and onions and everything on it.
Right.
Has the works.
That's also the works. Yes. Like, that's the works.
So if I was going to buy this, I would be messaging the seller for a little bit more clarification on that. But otherwise, just, I've always liked the Model 3, the look of it. And, you know, it's a little less often that you see the corresponding hard drive. So anyway, yeah, interesting auction to me.
And it's a 5-meg hard drive. You know, I mean,
what are you going to do with all that?
I mean, the photo of it, of course, is bigger than that. But
good point.
In the background, you can see actually that there's quite. I assume that this is all coming with it. That there's like a manual for it and some Radio Shack software and stuff like that. And you know, so. Looks like there's a fair amount of stuff here.
To me, it looks like somebody who went and picked this up and didn't even take it out of their truck before they posted it on eBay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the name of the seller is something like Estate Sale Depot. Oh. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So there are good and bad points.
Yeah, I went
on this
to
auction.
An estate sale at one point, and it's really kind of frustrating to be there. Like, you know, there was a particular set of things I was. After I knew why I wanted to go there, but they're like this little crowd of people with their phones out trying to look up, like, is this thing worth it for me to pick up and try to flip for more? And it's like, it seems so, I don't know, savage. But oh well.
Well, Jack, it looks like you added a couple things here. We're really on an 8-track binge.
I added one thing. I was thinking about the 8-tracks we were talking about before. I was earlier looking at images of what an 8-track cassette looks like on the inside, and I found a company called Telex made a device about the size of like an old LP turntable that was a 12-tape, 8-track changer. So this thing would rotate, just like a record would rotate, to put the cassette you want in the right position and drop it down a bit onto the playhead. And there's also a YouTube video that actually shows one of these things in action. And it is
you grew cool. all night.
96 tracks.
All night long.
96 tracks long. It's amazing. So this thing popping through, we got some Elvis Costello, we got the Best of Genesis, Crosby, Stills, Nash. It's a very nice little video showing this thing. Unfortunately, there's not one of these for sale currently on eBay at the moment. And I don't have 12 8-track cassettes either. So
yeah, see if I get those.
I'm not quite in the market for this, but I'm pretty excited by the concept.
You know what we need? In the movie Armageddon, you know, they're going to go off and blow up an asteroid to save the world, and they're asking him what they want, you know, and one of the guys says, and he wants 8-track tapes brought back. I think that's what we need.
Yeah, I mean, people these days, you know, everyone's excited about, oh, we're putting our new album out on vinyl. You know, everyone's pressing vinyl. No one's putting albums out on cassettes or 8-track cassette.
Mm. Or just wax cylinder.
Wax cylinder.
Make a comeback.
Wire recording.
Wire. I'm putting in a wire recording of my next album.
It sounds like a Trent Reznor type thing to do. They actually just Nine Inch Nails to go on a tangent. They're going on tour or whatever, and they're selling tickets to the tour dates in some sort of protest to Ticketmaster or something like that. Mm-hmm. You actually had to physically go at the moment that they went on sale and like line up at some sort of local ticket office to buy the tickets. They were not available online. I did not do that, but it sounded very, very old school.
But I can understand that though. Ticketmaster does need to be protested.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I remember though in high school actually, I mean, doing that, like going to whatever, you know, whatever outlet sold tickets. I mean, this was more like a store in a mall, you know, or like a record store or something. But you know, and actually standing in a line to get the tickets, you know, not like. Waiting, not like refresh, 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 refresh.
Or you would just say that to the person at the desk.
Refresh, refresh,
no, refresh, 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 until they finally take your order.
Yeah,
I might start doing
take
that.
Out. They take out one of those little spinny buffering wheels.
Yeah. But you know, the I seem to recall that you actually had a choice. You could dial, redial, 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 or you could go stand in that line. And sometimes the redialers would get the tickets before you got to the front of the line. But. Yes, I'm not sure. I don't know if the world has improved. Now, basically, people just buy up all the tickets so that they can then resell them for twice the price.
I don't know if the world has improved. It's pretty much the brand of this podcast, though. So,
do you remember the host topic for today?
What if 8-tracks had taken over?
All right, well, hey, you've got the microphone at the moment. Paul, why don't you tell us about your auctions?
Okay, so I actually only have a couple, and... 66.67% of them are newly fabricated things, not old. But
So I really love the title of this one, Teachatron. I'm imagining a giant robot with a big ruler that is looking over you while you're doing your multiplication tables.
Yeah.
So maybe that's just my headspace right now. Sorry.
So this thing is it's a weird little thing. I kind of want it. Actually, I should buy it. But anyway.
It's so cheap.
It really is, actually. What am I doing? But I'll tell you about it anyway. It's basically just, it's a little toy. It's a 1984 toy. But what's kind of cool about it is that it is in the form factor of like an Osborne or a compact. It's a luggable computer. Like now you can get a sort of like a fake laptop for your kid or whatever, maybe a little fake toy tablet or something, but this is back in the time when luggable computers were a thing. And so it's in the shape of it's got sort of a screen on the left and these little fake disk drives on the right and a little keyboard that flops out, and there are these little cards that you can put in the disk drive, and it will teach you things like math and so forth, I don't think you need batteries or anything. I think maybe it needs batteries, but basically
maybe for the light bulb.
Yeah, it's run by mirrors. There's like a little periscope, I think, that will show you something about like what the card is that you stuck in. So it comes with a little deck of, basically a deck of playing card sized things that you can put in these little fake disk drives. It appears to be, they put a ruler down by it, and it appears to be 8 inches wide. So
I'm disappointed. The photos are pretty low res. Like, I really want to see more detail here. But yeah.
Maybe I'll buy it and take photos. Take photos that are much larger than will fit on that Model 3 disk drive.
It is pretty amazing. I mean, I've never seen a toy computer that's based on a luggable, ever. So that alone makes it really interesting. And it's weird and cool as a mid-80s kids computer. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. And the fact that it's $25 buy it now is crazy. Or $50 if you want to get in a bidding war.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
It's also got a strap. Built-in strap. Look at that. White straps. You can just carry this thing over your shoulder.
Yeah. Confirm and pay. All right.
Okay, what else are you going to buy?
Sorry, right. Listeners.
See, that's the problem with this show.
Hey, look, the buy it now listing has ended.
Yeah. Anyway, well, I'll tell you all about it next time. Maybe the time after.
Next time on Shopping with Paul.
Okay,
I think this is the first time that one of us has actually bought something live while recording the show.
No, Michael's done it. Yeah.
Okay.
Although it's not usually one that he picked, but I can also tell you about the other one that I bought without putting on the list. But anyway, first, let me tell you about the Texalex TI-99-4A to Atari 2600 style joystick adapter. I thought this was kind of cool. So if you are a person who's using a TI-99-4A, you can get joysticks for them, of course, but they break and they're a little hard to repair. And the Atari 2600 style joystick is super common. You know, I don't know if they're easy to repair, but there are millions of them. And so what this is basically something that you plug into your TI-99-4A that lets you plug in Atari joysticks or Commodore joysticks or whatever, you know, like they're all the same.
This is really neat.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a 99 and the joysticks were broken, but even if they weren't broken, I probably would have broke them just out of spite because they were horrible. They're just terrible joysticks. So this is a cool product.
Nice.
And actually the other thing too is that the Atari 2600 joystick is enough of a standard that you could probably get like some sort of like Wi-Fi or Bluetooth or something like that, you know, version to plug into this adapter to plug into your 99-4A, right?
Mm.
So
sure.
Anyway, so that's cool. Pretty cool. It's a $16 buy it now, shipping from Texas, and it says 10 available. So presumably they're being made, and perhaps more would be made if more were bought. So the description is pretty clear about what it is. So it's a not very expensive, and it's probably worth it if you are a current TI-99-4A user. So, and the next thing I have is sort of, it's another sort of modern device for old computers. It is a cassette player for ZX Spectrum computers. It's a lot like the things that I am used to seeing for like Mac floppies or, you know, Apple II floppies or something like that, where, you know, it's like a hard drive emulator or something. But what this is a cassette emulator, because that's what the ZX Spectrum used. So, you have a little SD card and you can put in like, in the picture, it has a 2 gigabyte SD card, which must have an awful lot of cassettes on it.
Right.
But anyway, so this is an assembled device. You know, it has a little screen on it. Same screen. I'm sure this is a sort of a common part. It's the same screen, I think, that you can find on the floppy emu on for the Apple hardware. But and so it's $50 buy it now, shipping from Sochi. Ah. Yes, left over from the Olympics. But if you wanted to just build it yourself, you could actually also, if you look at what the other things the seller has, you can just buy the circuit board and put it together, and I think it's like $10 or something. And there's a bunch of other sort of Spectrum-related stuff, a keyboard and a power supply and stuff like that, that you can get from the seller. So if you're interested in that, you might also be interested in the other things the seller has.
Cool.
But of course, none of us have a ZX Spectrum.
No.
So I think we repeatedly cover, but nevertheless, I'm still...
I do, actually.
Oh.
All right, well.
Yeah. I've got now it's not the smaller Spectrum. It's the bigger ones. Is it the 128 plus 2?
Oh, yeah.
And the plus 3 guys, the ones that have a built-in cassette deck.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the long that. Ones. Yeah.
Yeah, a long time ago, a listener from the UK just surprised me and sent those to me. And I'm still very thankful about that. Got these cool computers all the way from across the pond.
Nice. So maybe I will mention the thing that I didn't put in the list because I bought it, is something like, this link that I just put in. It is, Interact Home Computer System. And
ooh, what is this? This is cool looking.
Yeah. So the one I got, all right. So first of all, this is the Interact, I think it's called the Model 1 or something like that. It's, Model Number 1. is what it's called. But this is a super early, not very successful computer that existed in a couple of different versions, but it's cassette-based. I think it's from like 1978, and it was discontinued in 1979. You know, yeah, I mean, I don't know very much about it, except that I think there was only like 1,000 of them or something made. I mean, it's like it's really kind of an unusual thing. And so the particular... I'll go ahead and link to this auction in the show notes. So this particular one that I'm linking to is it's one of the later ones that has real keys. The earlier ones had these, you know, sort of chiclet keyboards. But what's kind of nice about this particular one is that it has a lot of cassettes. So it has, I don't even know, it looks something like 30 cassettes there, and it has a box, and it has the better keyboard and a bunch of joysticks and things. So if you were inclined to investigate this computer. Oh, and actually it also has a number of like catalogs and articles and stuff about it too. So if you were interested in this, this is a good one to get. It is a buy it now for $400. So it's or $395. So it's, and actually also like a $57 shipping from California to me. So that was more than I would be willing to do. The one I grabbed was more like $100. And it was just for the machine and not all the extra stuff. But I knew that they were rare enough that I was kind of curious about it. And it showed it working on a TV screen, so I grabbed that, and I will investigate that later. But it's kind of an interesting machine anyway. Oh, and I think it has a cover too. It has some sort of dust cover.
To point out, this auction you're going to link to does have a make offer.
Oh, that's true button. Too. Mm.
Now, something I don't understand is it comes with a whole bunch of cassettes, and a lot of them are games. Mm-hmm. There's Star Trek, awesome, and yeah. Dogfight, and Regatta, and Volleyball, and etc. And each one will have the name of the program that's on there and a little symbol beside it, like it's a little graphic. But on the left-hand side, in red, is a letter, S-A-P, whatever. Mm-hmm. What did the... I can't figure out the code here. It's like Trailblazers has an A,
yeah.
Computer Color has an E, Touchdown has an E. Any idea what these letters mean?
That's a good question.
It's very weird code beside these things. It's not the category. Right. It's games seem to have random things. Message center. Like, I don't understand.
Yeah.
Why does Backgammon get an S and Breakthrough gets an A?
Arcade and Strategy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hangman.
That's
education.
Why you get to have one of these, mister.
Yeah. P, Programming.
An M for Message Center means... It's for message centers. Checkbooks balance is also M. So money, maybe?
We got E also.
Anyway, it's very weird. I was looking at this code like, I can't crack this code. Paul can in 2 seconds. I feel good about that. Whatever.
Sorry. But yeah, anyway, so I mean, I think the one that we're linking to is actually a nearly ideal auction or like, you know, listing for this computer if you were interested.
So it can be your second one.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, but
corner of the market.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested in it.
Paul's got all of them.
Right, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, so the one I got, or I will get, the one I paid for at least, has a cheesier keyboard. It's just the chiclet keys, and it has no tapes. It has no joysticks. It has the power supply. So it's quite possible that I'm not going to be able to do anything with it at all. I'm kind of hoping that somewhere out there there are wave files of the tapes or something. But
Or you'll have a new exciting story for our eBay shipping disasters.
Yeah, that'll be a pleasant surprise. But anyway, so I thought that was interesting. But the reason I have one coming to me is because I was trying to prepare for this podcast. So that's the problem. I've now bought half of the things I found for this podcast. Anyway, but that's it.
Well, alrighty then. I think we're done with eBay, and I guess that takes us to the closing discussion. So, Carrington, do you have anything to say for yourself?
I want to play the Omni game.
Yeah.
Eight tracks
no
in my
kidding.
Life now. That's all I got. And my building hasn't burned down during this episode, I believe.
At least as far as you know.
Yeah. As far as I know. My building is
hasn't,
currently
on fire. Hasn't reached your floor, at least.
What floor are you on?
I'm on 28, and they said the alarm was on 14. So, we will see.
Well, fingers crossed.
What better way to go out than an episode of RCR?
I can think of a lot of better ways to go out, but okay.
Jack, what about you?
So, you guys, I saw an amazing episode of Storage Wars. Are you all familiar with the show Storage Wars? It's a thing where
yes.
they have people bidding on the contents of an abandoned storage locker,
mm-hmm.
where they can look from the outside. They can't really examine, and they get to bid, and they sort of shouting about who wins the bid and all that stuff. There's like a weird sort of semi-scripted personal drama about the various junk dealers who are trying to buy all this crap. But this one episode, season 10, episode 1, it was amazing. So somebody buys the contents of one locker. I don't know what they paid. They paid like $1,000 or something based on what they thought might be in there. And it's all just boxes. They couldn't really see much. They're like, I got a good feeling. And so after all the bidding is done, they open it up and they pull out a bin, like a good, two arm carrying bin, and open it up. And it's full of like video game cartridges. It looks like, I forget what it was. Maybe it was kind of like Nintendo 64. It was like stuff 90s. It was not CDs and DVDs. It was cartridges.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, cool. Wow, this is great. Like, this might be $1,000 right here. Let's grab the next box. They grab another box. It's also full. Another box is also full. They probably had 20, 30, 40 big bins just full of video game cartridges. Like, if they sold them for $1 a piece, they would have more than $1,000 from all that. And some of them they could really sell for more than that. So it was cool. It was fun to see.
And they were all E.T.
They're all E.T.
Now, were they in the boxes or were they just...
No, they were just loose.
Loose cartridges?
Just loose cartridges,
okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was pretty cool to see just because they were not expecting. They were expecting to get something. And they always have at the end, they have like an estimate of what they think it's actually worth. And I don't remember what they said, but... Like, it was clearly worth a lot more than whatever they paid for it.
Hmm.
Just sort of fun to see, because a lot of the times, it's stuff, they find things in there that's just kind of random garbage, or sometimes something valuable. But here it was like, obviously someone had made a huge collection. It looked like it could have been the result of, like, say, somebody who owned a video game store where they took trade-ins, and just because someone had just amassed so much stuff and then had it in storage and abandoned it. So, worth digging up if you have a chance to see.
Nice. What network is that on?
What is it on? I think it's on A&E or something.
Okay.
Here in Sweden, we get it on something else. It just kind of randomly pops up on some channel we have. I don't really. And I watch it now. I don't watch it regularly, but I watch it now and then. And I happen to see that one, and I was like, "Damn, that was a good haul they got away with."
Nice. Well, Paul, what have you got?
I don't really have too much, actually. I realized just a couple of days ago that the deadline went by for submitting things for Kansas Fest, so I will once again just be going to watch, but that's all right. Not much is going on, but I remain optimistic for the rest of the summer.
It sounds like Kansas Fest is sounds like it's filling up. I guess it's not completely full, but it sounded like they had quite a few people committed already with the fees paid.
Oh yeah. If you're interested in going, you should definitely get on that soon.
Yeah, don't wait. So,
how about you?
Me? Well, had a lot of fun talking with Randy over on Floppy Days. He was doing an episode on the ZX80, 81, and kind of the U.S. counterparts, the Timex Sinclair 1000 and the 1500. And it was just, it's always fun chatting with Randy and interesting stuff. So if you're interested in those computers, and even if you're not, check it out, because it's just a
special crossover episode.
Yeah, yeah, fun right. episode. And he, you know, is always such a good researcher for the technical details and the historical details and things like that. And also is chatted with someone who had worked on an emulation, was very familiar with the technical specifications, you know, the down and dirty stuff on those systems. So anyway, also, I'd seen an interesting project come up, and I don't remember even where I saw it, but I had just bought a Raspberry Pi 3 on some kind of sale that they were having at Fry's, and then I saw this project where you can turn the Raspberry Pi into a cycle exact Commodore 1541 drive. And I thought, well, that would be fun to try. It was all, you know, free project, like just download the bits and wire it up and make it happen. And you got to have a little translator for the voltage because the old stuff's 5 volts. These days, everything's 3.3 volts. So, yeah, hook it up without letting out any of the smoke. But all the stuff's there on how to do it, and I set it up, and it worked on the first try. You know, the interesting thing about, yeah, I was so surprised. It's like, wow.
So to make it cycle exact, did they have to put a lot of, like, delay loops in there?
Well, here's the thing. The serial protocol, famously slow, right, between the 1541 and the Commodore 64. But the drive itself, actually a snazzy little unit, with its own CPU and RAM and ROM and, you know, an intelligent drive. And people did things with that, like, for instance, fast loaders. So they would kind of reprogram the drive and reprogram the Commodore 64 so that they could improve that speed problem. Well, if you're using a drive emulator that doesn't understand those kind of things, then it could conk out on you. Or if you're running a demo that was made for, you know, in the demo scene for the Commodore 64, and it does some magic in the interaction with the drive, and your drive emulator can't handle that, then it just fall over. But this emulator that this gentleman wrote for the Raspberry Pi emulates all of the bits, the different chips that were in the 1541. So when you send programs down the line and do these fancy-dancy things that people did to make it go faster and go better, it actually works with this deal. So it was fun to build. Just took me a few minutes, put it together, and now I've got a cycle exact emulation of, you know, what's probably one of the slowest drives on Earth.
Excellent. So, yeah, I mean, that seems like it's a pretty good use for. So how do you actually connect it to the computer?
Well, you know, you got to hack something together. There's a round DIN connector that Commodore used for its drives. And so you could either find a socket or find a plug and just chop it up. And that's what I did. I had a drive-to-drive plug that I chopped up and solder tinned the end so it'd go on a breadboard. And again, you got to make sure that you hook it up through this voltage translator, because if you don't, things are going to go badly for you. And also, Commodore drives like the Atari drives and some of the others were daisy chainable on the IEC bus. So if you want to daisy chain it to some other drives, you need to add another buffer chip in between. I didn't do that because I just used it as a single drive on the chain. But if I want to put it in a chain of drives later, I'm going to have to add in this TTL 7400 series chip. It's just a few bucks, just a couple bucks to add in this chip. Overall, I mean, this thing cost me less than $40 when all was said and done, because the voltage translator was cheap, and I got the Raspberry Pi and the power supply for $30. So it was a nice little weekend project.
Cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I seem to remember somebody, like, you were mentioning the smartness of the drives, and I think I remember somebody talking about going to, like, copy parties and stuff like that, where you'd set up the drives to copy one to the other, and then you could actually, like, unplug the computer and take it to somewhere else. You know, like, the drives would just keep doing their copying on their own.
Oh, interesting. I guess that's possible. It didn't have a ton of RAM in there, but it did have a 6502 processor in the drive itself. Huh. And that's all I got. So I guess that's it. Guess we're to the closing. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all of our shows at rcrpodcast.com. If you want to discuss either the podcast or pretty much anything retro computing, you can do so over at the VC Federation forums, vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow the Retro Computing Roundtable on Twitter. We're at RCR Podcast. We've got a Facebook group, which we'll have a link to in the show notes. You can send feedback to us, feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a proud member of the Throwback Network. Even though we don't want you to throw us back, you can find the Throwback Network and lots of other retro type activities, including retro computer stuff and other retro stuff, at throwbacknetwork.net. If you like the show, please write a review for us on iTunes. It helps other people out there with the same interests find us. And until next time,
Retro Compute!